Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, a lively conversation with two of our most esteemed crime writers, Peter Temple and Michael Rowbotham, looking at the craft of writing about murder. And in our final first-person reading of Yung Chang's Wild Swans, her mother and father, despite their service as Communist Party officials, are being accused of disloyalty to Mao. Last weekend, the inaugural Crime and Justice Festival was being held at the old Abbotsford Convent in Melbourne, bringing together writers, lawyers, social commentators and luminaries from the judiciary to look at writing about justice, human rights and, of course, crime fiction. Peter Temple won a Ned Kelly Award in 1997 for his first novel, Bad Debts. He subsequently won four more Ned Kelly Awards, the most recent of these being for the much-acclaimed novel, The Broken Shore, which also went on to win the ultimate plaudit for crime fiction, the International Gold Dagger Award. Michael Rowbotham started his literary life as a ghostwriter, lending his writing skills to politicians, pop stars and all manner of celebrities. His first novel, under his own name, was called Suspect, and it achieved an enormous amount of attention around the world. Since then, his books Lost, The Night Ferry and most recently Shatter have reinforced his reputation as one of the best architects of the psychological thriller. Peter and Michael, along with the literary editor of The Age newspaper, Jason Steger, talk about their unplanned journeys into the crime genre and the joys and agonies of wrestling a suspenseful story into being. Another thing that these two writers have in common is that they both started out as journalists. And so Jason Steger started by asking Peter Temple what impact journalism has had on his writing.
Left very deep scars on me and the books. I mean, I owe a lot to journalism, I suppose. It doesn't owe very much to me. I did a conventional journalism cadetship and became a court reporter and did general everything from shipping onwards and did time in the general newsroom and spent more time, I suppose, on courts than anything else and then became a sub-editor. But I've, for those of you who've been unfortunate enough to hear me before, I've dwelt at length on my experiences at the hands of sub-editors, some of the most ruthless men. They appear to me to be incredibly old then. I think they're a lot younger than I am now, unfortunately. But they were mostly English, and they had come up through the ranks, usually. They started as copy boys. Some of them hadn't finished school. But they were pedants of the most astonishing order. Most of them had come through the Manchester Guardian, which was vaguely left-wing, very high editorial standards, probably, when it was in Manchester, higher than Fleet Street standards. And they basically hated reporters, journalists. They hated them. And they looked at upon them as the enemy. And so when I'd been in the newsroom, I'd been absolutely awed by the people, the reporters around me, who were, you know, I realized them. When I got into the subs room and sat down with these elderly gentlemen, they spoke about my heroes as if they were complete morons in the thing.
Did you become one of these?
I did.
Ruthless.
I did. I did. And I discovered a talent for destruction. I mean, they would give you a pile, say, on copy paper, they'd give you 15,000 words and they'd say, well, take three pars out of this. Yeah. The first three, don't be stupid. And you'd find, eventually you'd learn that the story really started on page 64, that being the way journalists used to write. You know, we think ourselves into the story. A lot of novelists write that way too. So you learn to cut stuff very savagely, and I was brutalized by these people, there's no question about it. I'm thinking of demanding an apology. Many of my ex-students are demanding apologies from me too. So, Mrs. Underhill, I'm sorry. They taught me in a very... in a very cruel way, I'd have to say, that brevity was everything and correctness was everything and you didn't get a second chance. And that when it left you, it had to be right. No one was going to pick up after you. Proofreaders wouldn't pick up after you. After that, it was your responsibility. So it's an awesome thing. I mean, I was in my early 20s and hadn't been to university or anything.
You were the sort of person that used to terrorise me.
Yes, exactly. I hope we can continue this.
My one and only experience of subbing was when I first went over to London, and I couldn't get any reporting work. I left newspapers, the Fairfax, Fairfax in Sydney, and went to London. And I finally was given a night subbing on the Sun. This is the Murdoch Sun in London. And it was in the height of the Wapping dispute. And I'd arrived in Wapping. It all happened while I was travelling. So I had no idea what was, you know, that this had all gone on. And so I was offered this subbing shift, and I arrived out at Wapping and, of course, had to run the gauntlet of all
strike
the people.
Strike breaker.
Yeah. And if I'd opened my mouth, if I'd opened my mouth and they'd heard the Australian accent, they would have just torn me limb from limb. But I arrived and I was the most down-table sub on the Sun, and I was the Sun had what they call a sunspot, and they're a little 20-word little filler that goes on the end of a column if a story falls short.
Nibs, they call them.
There you go. And I was given the task of subbing a story about a couple that had dug up potatoes in their back garden and had washed them in the sink, and one of them had turned out to be a hand grenade, and the bomb squad had come and they detonated this in the back garden. And their name was, they had a double barrel surname, sort of John and Martha, you know, Smythe or something, and they came from Southend-on-Sea. So by the time I put their names and where they came from, I'd used sort of 11 words. I spent 6 hours trying to get this thing down to 20 words, and I finally got it down to 22, and shaking, I went up and I gave it to the chief sub, who proceeded to scrub out their name and call them Smith and say that they lived in Dover. And he put it through. And so in terms of... their accuracy didn't... They didn't seem to mind so much about accuracy.
Well, the Murdoch Press has always had a very high regard for accuracy.
So, but this need for brevity and accuracy, is that something that... Are those mantras that you remember while you write?
I think it's interesting. I mean, there are some... I'd be interested to know what Peter thinks about this. I think there are some writers... I mean, I know Stephen King always talks about writing long and then paring back. I tend to often... I mean, I write incredibly tightly and invariably have to actually expand because I have editors that come back and say, you know, you can make a bit more of that. You can actually expand on that a bit more, because I tend to be so brief. All that experience of tightening things up has sort of meant that I actually write too tightly at times. But then again, I was going to suggest that Peter should, you know, I don't think I would know any writer that writes as sparingly as he does, that he should edit one of my books, but he's just told me what a brutal bloody editor he is.
In a nice way.
What is nice about being brutal?
I don't know, Max Mosley likes people to nice and but to follow that on, I'm acutely conscious while I'm trying to write of every single word. And I remove everything. I mean, when I start the next day, I just go through it and take out everything that... To the point of incomprehensibility, and many people have said that the stuff is incomprehensible and you should put some stuff back. But I've always been drawn to that. I mean, how little do you actually have to write before somebody takes your meaning? How little can you say? You can get down to writing, doing it all in mime, I suppose, but there is something wonderful about communications that are just as fulsome, or not fulsome, but just as long as they need to be.
Yeah, less being more.
Well, I think in many cases this is more. I mean, I don't like exposition for a start. So, I mean, I hate having things explained to me in books. I mean, I don't like to describe characters very much. I think you should see them through their words. I've become a little more keen on landscape and stuff like that, which is a terrible indulgence. You know, because people say, oh, I enjoyed that stuff about the dogs. People, I've written some stuff about dogs. People like that. Now I have to put a dog in everything.
just don't kill one and you'd be fine.
No, you could never kill a dog.
So, but if you were, Peter, if you were editing your own books, would you take out the dogs and take out the...
No,
if
I wouldn't you were take being out a brute. Word. I would not change a word. I know genius when I see it. I'm not well disposed towards being edited at all. Not at all.
But
I've done so much work by the time I'm finished with this matter. I do not require editing. If it's either it's published the way it is, or I mean, I'm happy to have people point out stuff to me, like saying, "This doesn't make any sense. Nobody will understand this." That's if you read on, you'll understand it. But people don't want to read on. They want to know now. Well, they can wait. But I think if you put the effort into... but there is a kind of laziness in... I sense it in stuff I read because I've attempted to teach people to write and stuff like that, and I can see when people are clearing their throats. Mm. And unfortunately, the stuff remains in the book. There should be an editor to say to them, okay, we've got to chapter 3. You were just warming up. We're throwing the first 2 chapters away. We'll start here. And, you know, in every exchanges between characters, in dialogue, you know, first people say things to each other like, so you've come all the way from Sydney. Well, of course I've come all the way from bloody Sydney. How do you think I got here? I live in Sydney. So, you know, I like to just leave that junk out. Elmore Leonard said it. Well, you know, leave out the stuff that people skim over when they read. Mm. Just leave it out in the first place, and they won't have to skim over it when they read.
What about you, Michael? Are you opposed to exposition?
I mean, I think I take it as a badge of honour if I can get a book through. I mean, I know my first novel was sold on a part manuscript of 117 pages, and then lo and behold, you know, it was sold in a lot of territories, and everyone liked it until the Americans got to it, and what they wanted to change, they said that the beginning was too slow. They actually said that Americans weren't as intelligent as Europeans and Australians, which I thought was astonishing to say about their own countrymen. And they wanted to take out 3,000 words, but they wanted to take it out of the very 117 pages that they'd bought in the first place, you know, which I thought was totally insane. And I vowed, you know, I finally had to give way. I was a first-time writer, and it was Doubleday, and at that point we're riding high with sort of the Da Vinci Code and Grisham and... You know, they were a celebrated publisher, probably the most celebrated publisher in America. And I was gutted by having to take these 3,000 words out, and I sort of vowed it would never happen again. And thankfully, they've never asked. There's never been, you know, I agree with Peter. I'm happy when people point out the fact that, you know, Australianisms or other things drop into, you know, my UK settings that have to come out, obviously. But I'm not precious enough. If all my publishers say that something's wrong, then I'll obviously have a look at it. But I love it when a book goes through and they just don't touch it and they just say, no, we like it as it is.
But they were going to change your title, your most recent title.
Oh, I've had it.
To something truly wonderful.
Yeah, no, that's right. The Americans wanted to call, I wanted to call Shatter The Sleep of Reason, which was based on the famous Goya etching, The Sleep of Reason Creates Monsters. And it's a wonderful image for a psychological thriller and I thought a wonderful sort of atmospheric title for the book. But... my publisher's here, I shouldn't be saying this.
but they listen to Radio National.
That's true. But unfortunately the power, particularly in the UK, it's a very sad state of affairs there. Only 3% of the book trade there is still independent in the UK. Supermarkets dominate it. So when a supermarket chain like Tesco's looks at a jacket or a title and says, we can't sell that book, publishers listen. And the supermarket chain said that Sleep of Reason wasn't a title that they could see walking off their shelves, and so it became Shatter. And the Americans held the line for a long while, but now they have fallen into line, and they will call it Shatter when it comes out in America next year, which I'm a little sad. I'm pleased that it's the one title in different territories because there may even be people here that have picked up a book called The Drowning Man, which is in fact lost. It was given a different title in the UK, and it does create... great confusion.
Was that because of the television?
That was because of the TV show. That was when I came up with it before the TV show, but the TV show was sort of all-encompassing in its success, and it meant that the book... I mean, people just assumed the book was a TV tie-in. In the UK, they had a chance between hardback and paperback to change the name. In Australia, because it had won the Ned Kelly that year, they actually wanted to change the name here as well, and I actually had to fight with them and say that I've just won the Ned Kelly and you want to change the name of the book. Finally, they saw sense on that.
So, journalism, and then... So what turns you to crime?
Me? Who,
well, either of you, really, since you are our...
Well, I mean, I didn't turn to anything. I worked in journalism until I sort of ran out of jobs, and then I started teaching. I had taught before. I ended up teaching again, and I ran that into the ground quite comprehensively. And then I decided I'd have to write something, make a living, basically.
But why did you alight on crime fiction and why?
Well, I mean, literary fiction is... When I first left school, when I was a kid, when I first started working, and I was trying to read and trying to educate myself and trying to... surrounded by all these erudite people and having, you know, just having read mostly rubbish when I was at school. So I tried to read everything I could, and I read my way through Conrad. And, I read everything that I could lay my hand
on. I did exactly the same thing.
And then I thought, moving on from this, I should write a novel, a literary novel. I mean, it never crossed my mind that you'd settle down at 21 and write crime fiction. To hell with this. Dostoevsky, yeah, watch out. And then I settled down, and I was working as a journalist, and I had a typewriter and that sort of thing. And I wrote pages and pages of this absolute drivel. And of course, like all young writers, the only thing you have to draw on is your own childhood. Well, my childhood was incredibly boring, but punctuated by bursts of violence. And I didn't want to write about them, so I just wrote the boring stuff. And I got to about 22, 23, and I had a big box full of this rubbish. And I read it one holiday, and I thought, that's it. I'm going to have to wait 20 or 30 years. Well, something's happened to me before I do this. And I did. But by that time, I realized, although I enjoy reading anything, and literary fiction included, that it wasn't for me. The lack of plot I found disconcerting. The lack of narrative drive. On Chisel Beach is not me. No. I think they should just get on with it. And then I think something should happen. Maybe one of them should be killed. And then we could move on. It's only this long. I mean, hell, there are three more books to come out of that. Or one fat one. So, yeah, I thought, well, I'll write something with a bit of narrative, a bit of drive. Crime's good for that sort of thing. And then I found that I actually enjoyed it. And you could be mildly humorous if you wanted to. You could be descriptive. You could settle old scores. Because everybody who knows me finds a score settled in every book. Some of them I regret bitterly. They've settled the scores back, unfortunately.
But I remember 2-1. I remember talking to you when An Iron Rose came out, and you'd been reluctant to write another Jack Irish book after Bad Debts, and then you weren't sure about bringing Jack back. But you have, and with great success.
Yeah, I'll give you a minute at some point, Michael. I don't know. Not sure anybody wants to listen.
I was going to come to him after you dealt with Jack.
Well, I wrote the first book, and I thought, this is the only book I'll ever write. I put everything into it. No one said to me, if you're going to have a series, because I wasn't going to have a series, they said, leave something out. I mean, or put in a lot of interesting historical stuff that you don't dwell on now, but in later books, we'll refer to his traumatic childhood. Or, events, startling events. So we can mine the part. I just put everything in. And then I thought, that's it. And then when somebody said, listen, somebody would like another Jack Irish book. I said, I've written the Jack Irish book. It's finished. It's gone. And I then wrote An Iron Rose, which was another badly wounded male out in the sticks. And that sort of cleared. Yeah, then I realized I could possibly do another one. And then I thought that would be two, and then I would stop, and it's gone on that way. I thought four was it.
Yeah. This is how naive I was. When I wrote The Suspect, I had no idea I was writing a crime novel, because I thought I was writing a story. There's a body in there and a mystery. And it was two-book deals were the deals I sort of signed. And so when I sat down to write my second book, my publisher said, what are you going to write now? And I had this great idea for this sort of book about a rogue pope and had nothing to do with crime whatsoever. And they said, you can't do that. And I said, why? I said, you're a crime writer. And I said, get away. And I said, when? And they said, it's in your contract. I said, no, it's not. And of course it is. It says that you will write something of similar vein or of similar style as the first book you've written. And that was the first time that I realised that I'd actually sort of made this bed. And it took me a little while to get over. But, I love the crime genre, but I just wasn't aware that I was becoming a crime writer or being labelled that sort of quickly or that suddenly.
You were contractually a crime writer.
I was. It was contracted. And the idea of doing, I avoided series because I thought, if I give my main character Parkinson's disease, no one's going to want him to carry on. So, and I thought, that's good because I can avoid the series. And the other, I can sort of understand what Peter's saying. You're so exhausted. I mean, I'm sure with Jack Irish, when you've spent a year or 2 years or whatever, I liken the characters. It's like sleeping in a two-man tent with your best friend for a year, and it doesn't matter how good a friend they are, you're just so sick of them by the end of that process.
Brokeback
Mountain. and every time I finish a book with a character, I think I never want to see them again. I'm just so sick of them. And yet these are best friends. And what happens is, if I do another book in between, somewhere down the track, I'm sure you felt that with Jack, you suddenly thought, every idea that you thought you'd used up, somewhere in that process in between, you're doing another book, ideas come to you where you realise there's still mileage, you know, in this character and there's still stuff I can write.
Crime writers Michael Robotham and Peter Temple in conversation with literary editor Jason Steger at last weekend's inaugural Crime and Justice Festival in Melbourne. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. Here's Jason Steger again.
So what about the relationship with the characters then? Do they tap you on the shoulder?
They haunt you.
Does Jack haunt you, Peter?
No, not at all.
I mean, I remember Ian McEwan saying, talking about the characters in on Chesil Beach.
Yeah.
You know, when he finished him, they were dead. No, that's it. They're gone. Oh. So they were dead.
They were dead in the beginning, in my opinion.
Actually, I quite like it if they were dead, but then you get readers come to you and ask you, listen, what happened to... did Julianne have a girl or a boy or something like that? And you say, I don't know. And they go, what do you mean you don't know? She was pregnant at the end of that book. And you're going, well, that was the end. But they get quite irate if you can't tell them what actually happened further down the track. They expect you to have it all planned out.
But you like to bring characters back, don't you? I mean, not just
Joe. It's a throwback to the days as a ghostwriter, when I got to look through at the world through someone else's eyes, you know, every 12 months or when I was working on a new book. And to me, to take a new character, because I'm so tired or fed up with the character, or I feel I've used every idea I possibly had with that character, I like grabbing someone new. And I suppose publishers would love you to do a series, and I suppose I compromise, and I know Peter does, brings characters back. You've got a whole cast of characters that come in and out of the books and whatnot, and to a degree I do the same. Although I'll choose a different narrator if possible, because it keeps it fresh, hopefully. And I think, you know, it's funny, a very sad thing was said to me by a publisher a few weeks ago, and he said, Michael, your problem is you don't write the same book over and over again. And he said, that's what you really need to do. And I just thought, well, that's just tragic. I mean, there's no way I want to write the same book over and over again.
Some of us just have to. Some of us have no choice.
We don't.
It just happens.
It's not in your contract to write the same book over and over again.
And so many writers do fall into that thing of it's the same book again and again. And at the end of the day, they've got to be fresh in your own mind, the writer's mind. If you're going to make them fresh to a reader, you've got to come to it fresh yourself.
But how long do they remain fresh? I mean, by the time, given my method of operation, fresh. I mean, I've lived with it so long that all idea of it being fresh is long gone. I mean, it is so stale. Get up in the morning and just scroll, first of all, to find where you stopped. That takes us up to 11 o'clock. Coffee, that's 1. And then I think I'd better start reading this from the beginning again. I find it appalling. Did I write this? It is so boring. I'll start it another way. Then it's dark by then. This is Ballarat after all. I'm talking 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then I think, oh, no, I can't go on like this. I'll try again tomorrow. So fresh. No, it's so stale and musty and awful.
I always remember Tom Keneally talking about when he won the Booker Prize. What he loved most about this sort of big paycheck was that in the previous novels, he'd always been forced to finish this book that he hated. By the time he got two-thirds of the way through, he hated it. He hated the characters. And he just wanted to put it in the bottom drawer and leave it and go and do something else. And finally, he had the financial wherewithal to be able to do that. And, of course, he went years without being able to finish another novel. And he realised that financial necessity of actually finishing something that you feel is stale or you have fallen out of love with forces you to finish at times. And as we all know, those people that want to write, the biggest hurdle they get over is that of not just starting the same story over and over, but finishing something.
I can start anything. I've started thousands of books. but chapter two is the big problem.
You've just finished one, though, haven't you?
I have not.
Haven't you?
I heard you had.
Haven't you just sent that word
just to keep them quiet for a while. But,
isn't there?
Your publisher actually told me you delivered.
Lying swine.
So
listen, he's in denial, the boy.
So
I'm close to it. But when you know, it's a relative term. In close to it, I could be years away.
Look, this is no good at all. See, I was expecting you to come out with a book that would fall in a year that I wasn't up for a Ned Kelly. So therefore, someone else, I might have a chance of winning one.
I don't think I'm eligible for the Ned anymore. I think they've introduced a rule.
Have they? Yeah, once you win 17...
Five and out. It's like five French and out. Cricket. I'm gone.
but you are writing or have written another book which bounces off a character in The Broken Shore.
Yeah, I've written something.
And
Who
is the main character?
The point of, I didn't want to care. When I wrote The Broken Shore, which you know, met with a measure of success, which was a bad thing, basically, I have to tell you.
Why?
Well, it makes you, it's a bit like Keneally. It makes you think, it makes you very conscious of what you do. And you think, how did I pull this off?
What was the trick here?
So why this one? And this is a bad feeling. So I started looking at it in a different way. Thinking, when I'd finished writing it, I thought, just another piece of rubbish. But all of a sudden, other people start saying things quite serious things to you. So I started eyeing this book in a different way, without opening it, of course, just looking at it from a distance. And eventually I opened it and read bits of it again. And then, of course, there's the problem that you may begin to believe that you've written a halfway decent paragraph or even sentence, and this is always a bad thing. So I started reading some of it with admiration. And then I thought, well, how do I write this again? Well, obviously I can't write this again. I've got to do something else. Well, what is it? I thought, all right. And people kept saying, this sounds like the start of a series. I mean, this guy, he could be a series character. I thought, oh, God, now I've got one of those already. So I thought, well, I'd take a character from it, a small character from it, and do his story. That was the big mistake.
Tell us more.
Well, it's a matter of structure and form. I started, most of my stuff has been done in the first person. Mm. Very attractive, very seductive form, because in a sense it's you. I mean, it's the you would like to be. So you can do that. I wrote In the Evil Day in the third person, which I'd never done before. I found it incredibly difficult, but I began to enjoy it. I mean, to have more than one point of view, it was such a wonderful relief. And I could write these little short chapters with people speaking. People say, who the hell is this? I don't know either. We'll work it out later. And so on. I loved it. It was a wonderful experience, and nobody liked the book at all. I thought, yeah, that's my attempt at an airport novel. It's still standing in the hangar. So I then, in The Broken Shore, I wrote a first-person novel from a third-person perspective. There are no other points of view. Mm. You could not do a more stupid thing if you sat around for years. You have saddled yourself with all the disadvantages of the first person, which means you can have no other points of view and none of the advantages of the third person. Why did I do this? I have no idea. And why did I choose to continue it in the so-called sequel? I don't know. But instead that the theme of the so-called sequel to The Broken Shore is so much broader that the need for other points of view is overwhelming. And it has overwhelmed me. I sit there staring out of the window, overwhelmed. And this is what has taken so long. If I'd said, I'll go back to the first person, I'd have finished the thing years ago.
So you don't feel there's I'm interested, I mean, because obviously, Broken Shore was just an astonishingly brilliant book. And the success that it's had, is there an extra burden that you feel as a... Because you know that what you write next is going to, no matter what happens, the reviewers are going to compare it to Broken Shore.
Well, absolutely. You're on a hiding to nothing. There's no doubt about that. I've been on that hiding for quite a while, too. And I know who's going to do it. But there is, I mean, heightened expectations. Praise is a terrible thing. If you've grown up being praised, it will come naturally to you. You accept it. You know, some people take being praised very gracefully. They say, oh, thank you. I don't know what to do with praise. No idea at all. You know, you feel like saying, oh, bugger off. Oh, you don't mean that, do you? Look at me when you say that. So I've had people praising it. You think, why didn't you praise the other ones?
So what did you say when they gave you the dagger?
What did I say?
Yeah.
I insulted my English publishers, which was not a good idea. I said they've bought everything I'd ever written for the price of a second-hand Vauxhall Velox. which is an English motor car, you may remember, that went out of production, I think, in about 1954. Later on, my publisher said, well, we may have paid the price of a Vauxhall Velux, but we've spent money on you like a Maserati. Cutting remark. But, people before had, I mean, this is boring, but they'd given credit to everyone for the book, their books, their mothers, their grandparents were thanked. I mean, their publishers in particular, the editor, the people who'd edited the stuff, all sorts of. So I just said I'd wrote this thing myself. That's it.
I mean, going back to the question of pressure then.
I'm conscious of it. I mean, it's not hurting me in any way, yeah. But it is making me even more ponderous in the way I write. I mean, not ponderous in my style, I hope, because I take an axe to that on it every morning. But I'm just conscious of, is this thing working now? Mm. I've never had that feeling before. I've never cared whether it worked. We'll see whether it works when I'm finished. But now I'm thinking as I'm going along, is this working? Where's it going anyway? For me, where's it going is a terrible question. I have absolutely no idea where these things are going.
So you're more the sort of Stephen King style, aren't you, of sort of dig and reveal. You just set up the character and the premise and you don't sort of plot out.
But you hate plotting too, you once told me.
I hate plotting. I hate it.
Some people love it.
You know, I think plotting is the bane of my life. I mean,
but you do it well because there's always another twist around the corner.
Yeah, well, it's just because they're all bloody so intelligent out there that they can see twists coming a mile off, so you have to create another twist they don't see.
But you have to be ultra clever yourself in that case, which is, I'm not, you know...
So do you, Michael, do you always know where you're going?
No, well, I tend to have an ending in mind.
What about the whiteboard? Got the whiteboard?
No, I haven't got a whiteboard. I have an ending and then I spend 97% of the time convinced I can't get there, and because the characters have taken me off and the story's taken me off somewhere I can't possibly get back, and then I just hope I can come up with a better ending and stay where I am rather than have to sort of ditch it all. No, it's funny, I'm in the process of trying to write something now, and I think my big problem is, and maybe to a degree it's a bit like Peter was saying, I'm ponderous because I'm trying to plot it out more than I've ever done before, and it's boring in the end, and I can't come to the writing with any sense of excitement because it's almost like I know where it's going. Mm. I much prefer coming to it where I don't know where it's going. And I think I have to sort of go back to the old ways.
Well, I've said this before, but I've said everything before. If you know where the thing is going, why would the reader not know where it was going? I mean, if you work this whole thing out in advance, twist by twist, any person with half a brain would see where it is. And if you pick up, David Balducci, I get to page 3 and I think, I don't know what's happening here. And I can see the twist. I mean, the punches are being telegraphed so far ahead, it's being plotted like a movie. And movies, most Hollywood films, have a rigid structure. Everybody goes to these screenwriting courses. Everybody learns where the plot points are, how you have to do the switchback, all of that stuff. It's done that for the book. Well, you don't have to be particularly intelligent to see this stuff coming. The stuff I like is where you keep thinking, I don't know how they're going to get out of this. It's like Enid Blyton stories. And they're all in a hole. But Timmy the dog is not a clue to the way they'll get out. Timmy's found a bit of rope.
So you've got no idea. When you write, you've got no idea where you're going?
No.
And I think it takes, and I know it's something I've read that Elizabeth George said, that because I think she's a plotter.
She's a plotter.
And she said that it takes enormous self-confidence to be able to dig and reveal, to just write with... create a character and a premise and just let it go and with no idea of where you're going.
But it is. I mean, it is. I mean, it is. There's no net here. There's no safety net because the further you go into this thing, let's say you've written 60,000 words. Let's speak of a writer who might live in Ballarat who has written 65,000 words. And he wakes up one morning and he thinks, I have absolutely no idea where this thing's going, but it's going to have to go there within the next 20,000 words. Well, it clearly cannot, without unscrambling everything that's gone before. This is what panic looks like. It is. And, I mean, that's the reality of it. But I can't think of any other way to do it, because without that element of panic, there wouldn't be any reason to get up at all.
How much do you use stuff that you read or hear about in developing your plots? I mean, I suspect, Michael, you do. You take real events.
All of my ideas come from a what-if moment. You know, in each of the books, you can point to a conversation or a paragraph, and that was the seed that triggered the idea. I mean, I'll just give you one example with Shatter. It was a conversation with a guy called I worked with a guy called Paul Britton, who was a forensic psychologist in the UK. He was the guy that Jimmy McGovern based Cracker on. And Paul, one of the cases was, I was involved in helping Paul do several books, and one of the cases we couldn't mention that he'd worked on was helping the police try to catch a malicious phone caller who would basically trawl through local newspapers looking for photographs of teenage girls who'd been selected in a local sporting side or had won the Estedford or whatnot. And there'd be a photograph of the girl in a school uniform, mention of her, where she lived, and what school she went to. Just enough information for this chap to wait till Monday when the girl was at school and then trawl through the local phone book until he got the mother at home, and he had enough information to convince the mother that he had the daughter, that he'd kidnapped the daughter. And these women, he would make these women take off their clothes and walk out of their houses, and they'd be found still talking on a mobile phone, half frozen in a field. And Paul Tom, and that stayed in my mind, that story. I thought it was such a mental form of rape. And then, lo and behold, I began thinking about this for Shatter, and I came across an identical case in Australia where a man targeted 600 women, and the victim impact statements are just astonishing. The police had never seen anything like them. They're equivalent to rape victims. And he did exactly the same thing. He convinced women. The mothers aren't going to hang up and phone the school to find out their daughters are safe, because you'll stay on that phone if he's believable. And these men were very convincing. You will stay on that phone because that's that one lifeline you have to them. And I thought it was such a chilling sort of premise. It disturbed the hell out of me, actually, as a premise. But it was a very pure psychological thriller that I wanted to write. And that's the sort of thing that came, you know, it's something you just stumble across and just keep in the back of your mind until you can use it.
And, of course, the irony in the book is that your protagonist, Joe, is a psychologist.
Yeah, I suppose I wanted to take a man who repaired minds. You know, his career was to take damaged minds and repair them, and pit him against someone whose sole aim was to break open people's minds, to actually destroy them, and to have these two men sort of pitted against each other. And that's the basis of the story, really. Mm.
When you write them, do you think about the impact they're going to have on readers?
I suppose all writers in this sort of area think about pace. I mean, you don't want to be in a situation where if you're starting to bore yourself, you figure you've probably bored your reader by now. I am aware of my reader. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm writing something that I know I'd be interested in reading, you know. I mean, my wife's comment when she finished, she would only read this book during the day, and she said that we would never be invited to dinner again because no one would have a sick bastard like me in their house. that's true. That must have been, dinner invitations have been rather scarce.
Michael Robotham and Peter Temple speaking there to the literary editor of The Age newspaper, Jason Steger, as part of the inaugural Crime and Justice Festival in Melbourne last weekend. You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. Next on The Book Show, a journal about rare books founded by the creator of an action hero. In 1952, Ian Fleming, the man who gave us James Bond, also gave us The Book Collector, and we speak with Nicholas Barker, the man who's been editing this quarterly publication since 1965. He talks about the love of old books and about the way book collectors have embraced new technologies. Thanks this week go to the producers of The Book Show, Liz Gray, Michael Sheriffs, Sarah Lestrange, Kate Piercy, and technical producer Carey Dell. You can hear this program again by going to our website, you know, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Podcast us, find today's guest and book details there, send us a note. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.